It's time for our regular segment with barrister and solicitor with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. Good morning, Michael Mulligan. How you doing? It's Legally Speaking.
Hey, good morning. I'm doing great. Nice and warm and always good to be here.
Absolutely. And again, we had that really helpfully timed snowfall warning issued just before 10 a.m. about half an hour ago, another 10 centimeters on the way. So everybody should get comfortable. Today's going to get interesting. What do we have on the agenda?
The first case on the agenda, I think, is a fascinating one. It's from the Court of Appeal. And it was an appeal by two animal rights protesters who were convicted of breaking and entering and committing mischief and mischief in relation to a pig farm over in Abbotsford. And the background is that these protesters, first of all, the farmer or one of the farmers at this farm, which kept between 13,000 and 15,000 hogs, so no small farm. They, first of all, in March of 2019, they found four cameras hidden in the barn, and they called the police, and the police came and seized the cameras. And then in April, a busload of protesters showed up wearing matching coveralls and T-shirts and broke into the barn and refused to leave for several hours until the media was allowed to show up and walk around and look at the barn. Well, the media was called, they looked around the barn, and then the protesters left. But as they left, several of them were arrested and charged with various things. They were charged, first of all, with planting the camera back in March. On those charges, the jury acquitted, the jury didn't have to acquit them. The judge found there was just no evidence that these were the particular people who planted the camera. So they were in the clear on that, or camera, so they were in the clear on that front. But the jury who heard the case convicted them of breaking and entering and committing mischief and indeed committing mischief. Now, that brings us to what is mischief and what was this appeal all about? Well, mischief can involve interfering with the lawful use or enjoyment of property. And the there are two interesting issues on the appeal. The first issue on the appeal was that the protesters argued that because they, in their view, the pigs weren't being treated well, the activity at the farm wasn't lawful activity. Therefore, they couldn't interfere with the lawful use and enjoyment of the property because it wasn't lawful. That was their argument. Was that just fascinating? And indeed, there is some authority for that general proposition. And one of the cases that the protesters argued on the appeal was a case out of Ontario. And the fact pattern there was that there was a, apparently the accused was playing loud music at 3 a.m. And a neighbor complained about being unable to sleep. Hey, you're interfering with my lawful use and enjoyment of my property. I can't sleep. Yeah. But the neighbor who couldn't sleep was living in a studio which was not zoned for residential use. And so the judge said, well, look, you don't have any lawful right to be living there. It's a commercial-only property. Therefore, you, no lawful use was interfered with. It was just your unlawful use of the place. And so there's an acquittal. And so the protesters argued, well, we argue that the pigs weren't being taken care of well. Therefore, this wasn't a a lawful use and enjoyment of the property, which is an interesting argument. And in that regard, at the trial, the judge had found that that just wasn't relevant. And interestingly, and this is another little hiccup, the police somehow lost the SD cards from the cameras they seized.
Oh, no.
So they didn't have evidence of what was on them. They just got lost. And the judge found, well, yeah, they shouldn't have lost them. That was a serious problem. But there's no evidence that these people planted them anyways. And in the judge's view at the trial, well, how the pigs were treated just had nothing to do with anything. And so no remedy for that. And then interestingly, at the trial, there was some evidence from a vet who had showed up and looked at the circumstance when the protesters were there. And the vet expressed some alarm that all these protesters could infect the pigs with something, maybe COVID or something else. And so there was some discussion about whether the pigs were endangered by these protesters. Ultimately, there was some expert evidence the Crown led about from a person about the danger the pigs could have been put in by the protesters showing up in their barn, maybe coughing on them. And so that was sort of floating out there. Now, unfortunately for the protesters, the judges of the Court of Appeal, they consider that argument about like the unlawfully sleeping in the loft and you can't interfere with somebody doing something unlawful. But the judge found there was no evidence that there was anything unlawful going on when the protesters were there and when the media toured the farm was just a bunch of pigs. Nothing, there's no problem other than perhaps the protesters could have got them sick. And so the judge found the particular charge was interfering with the lawful use and enjoyment of the property on the day the busload of protesters showed up and occupied part of the barn. And so on that basis, the judge found that it was irrelevant whether something might have gone on that could have been captured on the SD cards and the cameras that the police lost, because that just wasn't part of what was charged here. And so on that basis, the judges from the Court of Appeals said, look, there's no problem, and there was no sort of no harm, no foul on losing the SD cards, because what might or might not have been captured on the hidden cameras really didn't impact on the mischief charge at all. Now, the other interesting element was that on the appeal, the protesters argued that the Crown shouldn't have been able to lead this expert evidence about the possibility of the pigs getting sick from the protesters, which was interesting. Now, on that front, the Court of Appeal found that, in fact, that evidence was not relevant because the charge wasn't getting the pigs sick, possibly. The charge was interfering with the lawful use and enjoyment of the barn by this protest showing up in the barn. And so that the Court of Appeal found the judge should either not have allowed that evidence or should have instructed the jury to ignore it or use caution about it because it had nothing to do with anything. Mm-hmm. But there's a section of the Criminal Code for Appeals, 686.1, mm-hmm. which is sometimes called a curative proviso. Mm-hmm. And that says that if there's no substantial wrong or miscarriage of justice, even if a judge makes some minor mistake, that it doesn't mean there has to be a new trial. Hmm. And so here the Court of Appeals said, well, we shouldn't have really had this evidence from the doctor about or the vet about the possibility of the pigs getting sick because that had just nothing to do with anything. What was being alleged here was you interfered with the farmer's ability to farm in the barn for 6 hours while you waited for the media to show up and tour the barn. Nothing came of that. And there was no evidence that there's anything unlawful going on that day. And so the conviction for breaking and entering and committing mischief and mischief were upheld. Although interesting arguments, I thought, and some creative legal thought, tried to make an analogy to that sleeping person in the commercially zoned loft. So that's the case of mischief from the barn. And that's the outcome.
All right, let's take our first break here at CFAX 1070. Legally speaking with Michael Mulligan from Mulligan Defense Lawyers. We'll continue after this. Back on the air here at CFAX 1070, it's Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan, barrister and solicitor with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. Michael, you've told us many times how complicated family law matters can be due to the emotionally charged nature of the relationships that are at stake. This can be made even more complicated when it comes to estate matters and inheritances, and it is against that backdrop that we see our next story come into view.
That is absolutely the case, and this is a local case from Victoria here, which is an example of perhaps a surefire way to ensure that there will be litigation over your estate. And the background is that a father who owned a home, who had three children, a few months before he passed away, I think he was ill, listed the home for sale. To make things more complicated, one of the children, the son, had lived in the home for many years. But the father sold the home and then put all of the money from the home sale into a joint account with his daughter. Then he passed away. His will provided that his estate was to be divided equally amongst his children. However, all of his assets was really the home. And when you put money into a joint account, if you pass away, the other person who's the joint account holder just automatically gets all the money and it doesn't go through the estate. Mm. And so that's what happened here. The daughter wound up with all of the money from the home and nothing for the other two kids. That, of course, is going to produce some consternation and unhappiness and many cases, as in this case, litigation. And unlike in a case where there's a will that does something like that, if you have a will that says all my money to one child, for example, if you don't make adequate provision, as the language, for the support of other people, including children or spouse, there can be an application to vary the will. That doesn't happen if the money is transferred outside the will, like I put it into a joint account, for example. And so the argument here was an argument I think we've touched on before, this concept called a resulting trust and the presumption of a resulting trust when you give somebody money or other valuables with nothing in consideration, right? If I just come up to you and hand you a briefcase with a bunch of cash in it for nothing, there is a there's a rebuttable presumption that I'm not just giving the briefcase of cash to you as a present, but in fact, you're holding it for me, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the assumption that the law makes.
Reasonable.
And if that's, sorry?
It's reasonable. Sort of
reasonable.
Yeah.
If I just come with no explanation, I just say, hold this, right? And I hand you a briefcase.
It must be a present. Yeah. No, I won't give it back. He gave it to me.
It's all mine. Mulligan gave it to me. He's very generous. Right?
Prove he didn't. Yeah.
Prove he didn't. So when you're the person, like in that case, holding the briefcase, you have the burden of proving to a judge on a standard of probably that I meant to give you the briefcase as a gift. So, you know, that's the law. That's kind of consistent with human expectations, which is great. That's one of the elements of the law that I really enjoy, right? Usually the outcome is going to be sort of in accordance with what a reasonable person would think. Well, how should this be handled, right? Should we assume that if I hand you something, it's yours? No, we don't assume that. And so that's the fact pattern. Now, the daughter who had the money in the account says, okay, well, I think I can prove that this was a gift. But that created an interesting issue. It's an interesting sort of legal issue people should be aware of. Most people have heard of the concept of hearsay evidence, right?
Yes. Yeah.
The idea there is that generally a witness can testify about things they saw or did, not what other people told them happened, right? And so, like, if there's a bank robbery and the teller sees the bank robber and tells a police officer, yeah, the bank robber was 6'2" with blonde hair, if you want evidence of what the bank robber looks like, you can't call the police officer that talked to the teller or the teller's best, you know, neighbor or somebody who the teller described what happened to. You call the teller, right? The best person actually saw it, not somebody who talked to that person. Now, there's a thing, just think about this. You're trying to, you know, the daughter's trying to establish that the father intended this money to be a gift for her, and he's passed away. And so necessarily, virtually, she's going to try to rely upon, well, what did the father say about that, right? Unless it's written down, this is a gift for you and no one else, it raises that issue. And so the judge had to deal with the issue of, are statements allegedly made by the father to the daughter admissible to prove that this was a gift? And on the face of it, those would be hearsay because the father's not around. It's just somebody saying, somebody else said this to me. Now, there are some in the law, and we had for many years sort of various sort of exceptions to the hearsay rule. Like, for example, there's one that still exists called the dying declaration exception to the hearsay rule. That would be, let's say I'm shot and I know I'm going to die, and as I'm laying there on the sidewalk, I say to the police officer who shows up, you know, Sterling shot me, and then I pass away. That would be
a jerk thing to do. Yeah,
a jerk thing to do. If not true, terrible. But
yeah,
the idea there would be people are unlikely to exclaim something that's false as they know they're about to pass away, and so the law carved out an exception for that. But in addition to that, and various other sort of specific exceptions, the Supreme Court of Canada a number of years ago created what's called a principal exception to the hearsay rule. And what it requires a judge to do, and here are the statements, like the daughter said, well, the father at one point said to her, I want you to have the money from the house sale. And then another occasion, she says, the father said to her, he's been living, referring to the brother, rent-free all these years. This money is yours, right? Those are pretty important, if true and admissible.
Yeah.
And so the principled exception requires a judge to, first of all, say, is it necessary to accept hearsay evidence, right? So that necessity would be, let's say, in the example of the bank robbery and the teller, if the teller is still alive and kicking, well, just call the teller to describe what the bank robber looked like, not somebody the teller talked to, right? Why do we want to create a game of telephone if we could call the actual witness, right? Now, here, the father passed away. So the judge said, well, it meets that part of the test. It's necessary in the sense that there's no other way to get this evidence about what the father's intention was. He's gone. And then if it's necessary, the judge has to analyze whether there is sort of circumstances that would establish reliability, at least to the threshold of the evidence being admissible. And that doesn't mean that the judge or jury has to believe the evidence, but are there some circumstances here which would cause the judge to conclude, yes, it's both necessary because we can't get the evidence any other way? And is there some circumstances of reliability that would make the statements admissible? And that's really the principal exception. Hmm. And here, the judge found that the daughter was an apparently credible witness and gave the evidence about what was said in a straightforward fashion and found that it did meet that test. And so the judge found those statements to be admissible. And on the basis of those statements, largely, because those are pretty compelling if they're accepted,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The judge found that that did rebut that presumption that the money was put in as a trust holding it for others or to be given back to the person, and found that the daughter had succeeded here in establishing that there is evidence on a balance of probabilities that the father intended the money from the house sale to be a gift just to her. And so the net outcome of this is the daughter gets to keep all of the money and nothing to the brother. And so that's the outcome. All those things people should be aware of. But I suppose one of the bigger takeaways there, a couple, would be, first of all, carefully consider if you want to do this, because you're almost certain to produce litigation.
Yes.
Second of all, if you are doing it and you conclude there's some good reason to do it, like the father, obviously, on the daughter's evidence, concluded that, well, the brother had got to live for many years rent-free in the house, so thought it was fair to give all the money to her. Well, fine. That's his intention. It would be a wise idea to write that down. Make clear what you're doing. Right? I'm giving this to you as a gift, and I'm doing it because your brother lived there rent-free for 10 years, and so I've concluded this is a fair distribution. Thank you very much. Right?
Yeah.
You would probably save all of this litigation. But if you don't do that, you'll produce this, so now the daughter will get all the money, minus whatever it's cost here to litigate the issue about whether that should have been given to her. So that's the Victoria case, the gift of the house.
Up next, a recreational soccer game, a slide tackle, and a substantial cash award.
Yeah, this was interesting. This is another Court of Appeal decision, and it was a case involving a recreational soccer game where there was a slide tackle. And the slide tackle, unfortunately, and for those that don't know what a slide tackle is, it would be a defensive move by a soccer player trying to get the ball away from somebody who's got it by sliding into them, often with like one leg outstretched, trying to kick the ball away. And interestingly, that is a permitted maneuver under FIFA rules. This game is being played under FIFA rules.
Hmm.
Now, the rules, however, provide that that kind of a side tackle is not permitted if it is, and it uses various language, careless, reckless, or using excessive force. So there's a judgment call there about how that could be performed. And in this case, there was this slide tackle, which was from kind of behind into the left of a person, and it wound up impacting, I think, rather than hitting just the ball with the foot of the tackler, although the use of the term tackle is sort of interesting, because that would sort of imply some physical contact with the person, but the concept would be you're trying to hit the ball, not the person. Here, a person got hit, person goes down and seriously injures their shoulder. The referee at the time gave the tackler a yellow card. For soccer fans, that is distinct, of course, that's like a warning, distinct from a red card, which would be you're out of the game, right? And so that's the fact pattern. Now, there are a couple of things to be said about that. First of all, on the appeal here, the argument was, in part, hey, this was sort of an agreed-to part of the game. You kind of consented to this risk with this kind of a tackle, because, look, after all, side tackles are lawful within the rules of the game. And moreover, one of the arguments made both at trial and on the appeal was, hey, this was a very experienced referee. Apparently he was 71 years of age with a wealth of experience, was very close to the play, but didn't give the person a red card, give him a yellow card. And so part of the argument was, well, look, surely that is some pretty compelling indication that this wasn't so far out of the rules and so reckless that it would attract civil liability. Now, the Court of Appeal, this is a good line, said, look, you know, the referee may be in charge of the game, but the judge is in charge of the lawsuit. And so, yeah, even though that was the conclusion of the referee at the time, which was described by the Court of Appeal as perhaps being very generous on the part of the charitable on the part of the ref, it was the judge who was in charge of the litigation and not the ref. And the referee did describe the tackle as being very reckless. At least that was a description at trial. Now, the other thing that made me smile reading this case, given that we're in Canada, is that the Court of Appeal found it necessary to draw a hockey analogy so that those of us in Canada could understand what on earth is going on here, perhaps given the popularity of hockey. And so the Court of Appeal says, by analogy, open ice body checking is permitted in hockey. However, liability and negligence may flow if a body check is executed in a manner that exposes an opponent to an unreasonable risk of harm. I'm sure that many of the readers, listeners are like, oh, I see. Okay. It's like a body check.
Yeah.
The Court of Appeal concluded that, look, even though this may be a permitted maneuver, and even though the ref in this case was very charitable and didn't give the player a red card for what they observed from only 10 or 12 yards away, ultimately, this was the sort of conduct which, even according to the FIFA rules, should have probably resulted in a red card, which is appropriate where a tackle or charge is undertaken, in the language is with excessive force or endangers the safety of an opponent, and is described as a serious foul play. And so, much like in hockey, you can have body checking may be lawful, but if you do it in a completely reckless way, such that you endanger somebody, you can be civilly liable. And so the Court of Appeal here on the appeal upheld the award, and it was something in excess of $100,000 for the injury suffered by the player who got hit. And so I guess the takeaway is when you're playing any kind of a recreational game, hockey, soccer, or otherwise, be careful. You're not in a negligence-free zone, even though by playing those things, you clearly consented to some risk of something happening. But if you go too far and you engage in reckless and excessive behavior, even though some form of it might be contemplated by the rules, you can wind up on the hook if you cause a serious injury to somebody else. And that's the outcome here.
Michael Mulligan with Mulligan Defense Lawyers, legally speaking, during the second half of our second hour every Thursday on CFAX 1070. Michael, thank you. Pleasure as always.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye now.